VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game World Cup Daily from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer and thank you for joining us. Over the next month, we're going to be bringing you podcasts every match day of the World Cup after 10 o'clock UK time every night in our studio that would rival ITV's grand set. In fact, I think their designers might have worked with us here previously. Anyhow, with me today, the deputy football correspondent for The Times, Matt Hughes. Hello.
Hello.
In Moscow, having just watched Russia romp to a 5-0 victory over Saudi Arabia in the opening game of this tournament, we'll be hearing from Oliver Kay. And we'll be discussing the story dominating the headlines off the field, Spain sacking their manager. Gab Marcotti joins us later. But first, let's get an update from the England camp in Rapino with Henry Winter. Henry, how's it all going out in Russia?
It's good, Natalie. They've cleared the dead seal off the beach, which has made the early morning run slightly easier. I don't have any sort of strange hurdling to do. No, it's lovely. The sun's out. The players have been very helpful, very open, which is part of Gareth Southgate's or Glasnost regime with the press, which is very welcome. And look, they have to deliver on the pitch. But the culture of suspicion and paranoia has lifted for now.
For now, indeed. We'll talk a bit more about the openness of the squad a little bit later, but it's not too long until England's campaign gets underway in Volgograd. And based on the training sessions you've been watching for us, we're 90% confident of what that team will be against Tunisia on Monday?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we get booted out of training, but the suggestion is that when England put the bibs on, as we call it, it looks like Pickford obviously being number one, he will be in goal, with Trippier and Young as wing-backs, back three of Walker, Stones and Maguire, Henderson holding with Ali and Jesse Lingard pushing on towards Sterling and Kane.
An attacking formation, Matt, as we expected.
Yeah, I think the key, really, in any World Cup is to get off to a good start. And Southgate clearly thinks he doesn't need two pivot players, as he calls them, in Henderson and Dyer in the same team. Against Tunisia and Panama the first two games. So I think it makes sense to use Ali and Lingard as runners, really, in that midfield behind Sterling and Kane. I guess my only quibble would be probably with the back five, Maguire over Cahill. I'm certain that's what he'll do. Gareth Southgate loves Harry Maguire, but I worry about his lack of mobility and the ease with which opponents can turn him. And I also thought in the two warm-up games, if it was a head-to-head, Danny Rose is better than Ashley Young, but you know, we're kind of splitting hairs, really. That probably is England's strongest team for the games that are coming up.
Yeah, I think that the Harry Maguire decision is the one that is more surprising of any of them. But you mentioned there that Southgate rates Maguire. Why do you think he would have opted for him then over Cahill?
He thinks he's better on the ball, is the bottom line, and he wants, obviously, wants England to play from the back, and he's built his defence around John Stones all season, despite the fact that he's not played that much for Man City. And he basically thinks Harry Maguire is a better footballer than Gary Cahill, which he probably is, but is he a better defender? It'd be interesting to see if England progress through the tournament and get up against better opposition, whether Gareth is willing to sort of alter his principles a bit and maybe go with a more robust defender.
Jordan Henderson, we expect to be chosen over Eric Dyer, two important players with parts to play, no doubt, in this World Cup. But Henry, it's a case of choosing the system over the players this time.
Yes, to an extent. I mean, if you look at Gareth Southgate's career with England, I think he quite liked playing that system or version of that system under Glenn Hoddle when he was in England international.
I agree with Matt on Rose and Young. I think England are a bit top-heavy on right-footed players, and with Young, perhaps not in the first two games, when he comes up against the better quality right-back, he will automatically show him out wide onto his weaker left. Young always wants to check inside, so I do think that is a slight issue. I really like Rose. I think he's a terrific player, as well as having that left foot. I think he's just a little bit rusty, and he's probably just a few minutes behind in terms of what he can deliver. In terms of the centre of it, Henderson has had such a good season. He'll be leading. He'll be a one-man pressing machine, hunting and destroying in midfield, looking for that ball. I'm a huge Eric Dyer fan. I mean, he has been sporting some rather fetching strapping on his left thigh in the last couple of training sessions. But I imagine, as Matt was saying, there'll be a double pivot against Belgium when you need more sort of security in midfield, and he'll partner Henderson then. But you know what happens, Natalie, with teams in tournaments? They always evolve. So Maguire may start and Cahill may come in. I mean, Cahill, as Matt says, has been playing well, but I'm a big Maguire fan. My only concern is concentration. He can slightly get caught out of position, and you know, he does occasionally have a mistake in him. Southgate clearly feels that what he can bring by stepping into midfield, and England is so short of long-range passes, and Maguire can sort of spin a 50-yard ball from left to right. So I think he's in there for that as much as his defending.
What Maguire only has 5 caps for England. Does international experience count for anything? Does it matter at a World Cup, Matt?
I think it does, yeah. But experience of losing isn't great, as much use, yeah. Which is what I think Southgate concluded when he was putting his squad together, and he was very, very quick to jettison the sort of Rooney, Hart, Wilshere brigade. So it's what we're seeing is a team that's growing and evolving together, and Southgate has kind of put form and time spent in the squad above experience, really, which is a slight gamble, and we'll see if it pays off.
The team evolving and the team bowling the media over, Henry.
Well, tenpin bowling, yeah, yes. Definitely. It was great when they turned up. This is a slightly surreal place. The FA have booked as the media centre. It's upstairs in a local hotel called the Cromwell. And it's like going into an amusement arcade, which makes a change from the usual England circus. And there's a dartboard there. There's tenpin bowling. I had a go early and got absolutely smashed by a slightly slow-moving man from the Express, which was very humiliating. And he was so far ahead, he actually declared and went off early for lunch and just sort of left me there.
Henry, you've let us down.
Miles behind. Absolutely let us down. Yeah, no lucky strike for me.
but tell us a bit more then about this team that seem to be enjoying each other's company.
They are. I mean, you know, obviously they're, for the first time in my experience of, 25-odd years of doing this, very odd in some cases, they seem to be enjoying the media. They come out, you know, they were doing the bowling, there was a bit of darts, so there was a lot of chat. And what's been very noticeable is that when they've done their media duties, they actually hang around for about 5-10 minutes for a little sort of chat afterwards. It's actually sort of quite civilised, which is a word I've never used with England. The bonding actually between the players, I mean, that is something that's partly done through technology. They're all a couple of WhatsApp groups they've got. They're playing Fortnite. They've, you know, obviously they're going into the physios and talking there and having their massages and watching the games. They watch the game tonight. But also on a very sort of serious, somber note, I was really impressed with the way they handled the Grenfell tribute today. And fair play to Raheem Sterling. He's obviously been heavily involved in the Grenfell campaign and fundraising for it, along with Ryan Bertrand, another England player who didn't make the squad. And they did it really well today. They came out before training. It was all very quiet. They were soberly dressed in sort of black training tops. And, you know, minute silence, applause, and then obviously they got on with training. But, you know, it's civilised. It's the way it should be, but it's the way it hasn't been recently.
It seems like the culture is improving in the England camp. Matt, what do you make of the players, if you like, cozying up to the media?
I think they've responded to the way Gareth Southgate wants to run things, really. I mean, what's interesting, what I picked up at St George's Park before they left, was previous years, the people who were doing media were coming on their own and they couldn't wait to leave, as Henry had said. But this year, before this tournament, FA have tried to do it all together and all the players are basically taking responsibility. In previous regimes, there were certain players who just would not engage with the media at all. You know, Ashley Cole for years and years, and then at various other points, John Terry, even Wayne Rooney before he was captain, just wouldn't talk. And it was always basically, you know, nice Gary Cahill, nice James Milner was trotted out, which I'm, you know, as well as being frustrating as a journalist, it didn't reflect well on the group because they weren't, as a team, taking their responsibilities seriously and collectively, and this group are, which, you know, augurs well. Obviously, you know, they lose on Monday, things could change. So we will see.
How can one man, and I'm obviously referring to Gareth Southgate, change something so much in such a short space of time?
The manager of any club, any organisation, sets the tone, and I think part of the reason is Gareth Southgate. He's worked for the FA for a very long time, on and off, since 2011, really. So he's got a lot of goodwill inside the organisation. And just the way he approaches things, he sort of appears to be quite consensual, but ultimately he tends to get his own way. He's sort of got a quiet authority, which, you know, it's hard to have in football. And I think it just reflects on the standing he has, and let's just hope it survives the next month.
Looking ahead then to Monday night's game, Henry, Harry Kane has said that England need to be aggressive and brave. Is that easier said than done?
I mean, one of the reasons why it is pretty happy squad is it's a very young squad. You know, they're I don't think there's anyone, that any sort of cynical players who's played 20, 30 games and he's seen the sort of, you know, the dark side of playing for England when the headlines are really bad. I mean, I think there are, what, four of them still left over from Iceland who are likely to start on Monday. But, you know, they're still sort of young and exuberant and positive and optimistic. So, you know, I think that's very positive going into Monday.
The Game, World Cup Daily from The Times with Natalie Sawyer.
You can hear live commentary of all Friday's games on TalkSport, including Egypt taking on Uruguay at 1 o'clock, Morocco versus Iran at 3 o'clock, and the huge clash between Spain and Portugal live from 7 o'clock on TalkSport. The World Cup as a tournament is up and running, and it was the perfect start for the host nation, Russia, as they thumped Saudi Arabia 5-0 in Moscow. Oliver Kay was in the Luzhniki Stadium. Oliver, good to speak to you this evening.
Good to speak to you.
Let's ask simply, were Russia that good, or were Saudi Arabia simply that bad?
We've probably seen better performances than Russia's, although it was very good and very surprising, you know, surprised a lot of people. But I don't know how many worse performances we've seen at a World Cup than Saudi Arabia's tonight. It was dreadful. It was I remember as a 7-year-old boy, there was El Salvador lost 10-1 to Hungary in a game at the 1982 World Cup, and that was. Reckoned to be spectacularly inept, and I'd say that was this tonight from Saudi Arabia was almost on that scale. And it was strange because they had quite a lot of possession and looked tidy enough in possession, but it was just, you know, they just collapsed every time they were attacked, and it was I think the Russian fans and players probably just couldn't believe their luck.
Defensively, they certainly seem to be all over the place. But it was star performance from Alexander Golovin, two assists and the final goal as well, that free kick in the 90th minute. Also, Denis Cheryshev, he scored a brace. His second in particular was a right cracker, wasn't it?
There is known to be talent in this squad, from those two in particular, and from Jagoev, who went off injured early on, sadly for him. But, you know, it has been felt in Russia, like, you know, there just wasn't a team emerging in the lead in the build-up to this tournament. The expectations seem to have been very, very low.
Yeah, that sort of leads me nicely on to the fact that the Times out, or the Moscow Times, their headlines were doomed to fail, destined. No relation whatsoever. We need to make that point, obviously. But they said doomed to fail, destined for defeat. They were saying that this was the worst generation in Russian football history. Too early for them to have been so critical, do you think?
Well, I know the results have been awful in the build up. They did not. I think they hadn't won any of their past seven warm-up matches. They played Turkey and Greece, was it? Or no, Turkey and Austria in the final two warm-up matches, probably intended or expected to build up a bit of confidence in those games, and didn't win either of those either. I think that had they not won tonight, it was going to be their worst run since 1912. I think the doubts that people have had about them were entirely reasonable doubts. And even, you know, someone like Andrei Kanchelskis had been interviewed this week and said, "This is the worst Russian team I've ever seen." And to be honest, they haven't been, you know, apart from getting to the semi-finals of the Euro 2008, they haven't been a good team for a while, really. They've not got beyond the group stage of any of the last six World Cups. But this squad, obviously, expectations are big usually on a home nation, but I think everybody had been sort of revising and lowering those expectations frantically as the tournament approached. Yet suddenly now, after a result like that and a performance like that and all those spectacular goals, I mean, the mood inside the stadium was fantastic, and I think they'll probably have some real momentum to take them into the much harder games against Uruguay and Egypt as they look to qualify from Group A.
It makes a real difference to the tournament. I know it's a cliche, but in my experience, it is true. I mean, the best tournament, the most enjoyable tournament I've been to was Germany 2006, when Germany obviously did very well, got to the semi-finals unexpectedly, and had a kind of deeper meaning with sort of, you know, the first time that Germany as a nation had felt kind of really united in the whatever 16 years it was then since unification. And South Africa 2010, they didn't do so well, wasn't the same. And Brazil obviously were humiliated in the semi-finals 4 years ago, but obviously before they had done well. And I remember an extraordinary evening in São Paulo before England played Uruguay. The night before, Brazil had won a game. I can't remember who it was against. We were sort of watching, and you've never seen a party like it. It was extraordinary. There's just sort of like a mass kind of Roman orgy going on, basically. There are people having sex in the streets.
I was just thinking it's a samba, but you've gone down a different route.
Ollie was probably still filing his preview. Legendary late. We went out for a drink. But yeah, I mean, the atmosphere can really catch fire. And I'm interested, Ollie, what it's like in Moscow. Mm. You know, in France 2 years ago, Paris, you wouldn't really know there was a tournament on because, you know, Parisians are a little bit snooty. The Muscovites kind of really got into it.
I think they're being, you know, I don't think it's a city that you would have expected to necessarily embrace a World Cup in quite the way that Rio did. But it's a city that's got, you know, four very good teams. It's, there is football passion everywhere. But I remember being here at the Champions League final. What was that? 8 years ago? No, 10 years ago. And you would hardly have known that was on at the time. Yet this, you know, one of the reasons why you would have no doubt that there was a World Cup on, as well as the mood tonight after this win, is just the sheer number of fans who've travelled from South America, in particular from Latin America, from Mexico, from Colombia, from Brazil, Argentina, Costa Rica, and particularly from Peru. It's staggering how many of the travelling fans who are here are from Latin America rather than from Europe. And it's, you know, they bring a lot of colour, they bring a lot of noise. But also, you know, Iranian fans, Egyptian fans, Saudi Arabian fans. It seems like the whole world is converging on Moscow, but perhaps not Europe in the same numbers, which is interesting. I don't know whether that's about, you know, people in Europe being scared off by the expense, or the which I can understand, or by the, you know, scare stories and some of the media coverage, or whether it's just, I don't know, a bit less raw enthusiasm for the national team, but all the noise is coming from, as I said, the Latin Americans in particular. It's amazing, and it'll be great when they get started, because it's most of them are still several days away from their first game, which is in many cases happening hundreds of miles from here. So goodness knows what it'll be like around the stadiums in those cities on those match days.
Well, you mind out for those Roman orgies, as Matt told us about. But speaking,
I generally do.
But speaking of the mood, Alison Rudd, she's out in Kazan, and she's written tomorrow to say that the celebrations have been muted there. She says that the Australians have been the ones there partying the most of anyone in Kazan. And I wonder, Russia, as Russia is and not as the Soviet Union, they've never reached the knockout stage of a World Cup, Matt. And despite the victory, they might still find it hard to qualify from their group with Uruguay and Egypt in there.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a fascinating game against Egypt, isn't it? You would think the extent of Mo Salah's fitness will be instrumental. You would expect Uruguay to get through the group, and you would expect all of them to beat Saudi Arabia comfortably. Obviously, the five goals, their goal difference could ultimately play a part. So I think if they can get anything from the Egypt game, they'll be in a good place.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Game, World Cup Daily from The Times with Natalie Sawyer.
We'll be giving you a Times trivia teaser question every day on every podcast, as provided by one of the greats in the world of stats, our very own Bill Edgar. Our question today, who's the last England-born player to win the World Cup? We'll give you the answer and a new question on Friday's podcast. There is a huge game on Friday night with Spain and Portugal taking on each other in Group B. The game, of course, been largely overshadowed by the news of the sacking of the Spain manager, Julen Lopetegui. Gab Marcotti joins us now. Gab, I don't know how you can make any sense of it, but incredible scenes that came out of the Spanish camp this week.
Yeah, it was remarkable. And I think the remarkable bit, obviously, Julen Lopetegui had done very well and made Spain one of the favourites for the World Cup. What's remarkable isn't so much, I think, that Real Madrid decided to turn to him, and it really was kind of a last-minute thing, obviously, after the sacking of Zinedine Zidane and after sort of, asking after Pochettino and Klopp and Allegri and getting a bunch of no's. But it's the fact that the Spanish FA decided, you know what, you're going to go and announce this without basically even telling us, bought a few minutes earlier, that's fine. We're just going to sack you on the spot. And that's pretty much what they did with Lopetegui, with the head of the Spanish FA, who was due to vote in the FIFA Congress on Wednesday, flying out to the training camp and basically telling him, be gone, good riddance, you're not needed, go enjoy Madrid.
I mean, it's quite shocking, isn't it, Matt? What did you make of it all?
It's just staggering, really. And I actually respect the Spanish Federation for acting the way they did. I mean, his negotiations with Real Madrid must have been going on for days, if not weeks. So not even to give his employers only 5 minutes' notice before Real Madrid basically told the world. It's just extraordinary. I was talking to a contact at Wolves yesterday, actually. He reminded me that Lopetegui had done a similar thing with them. Apparently, he basically agreed to join Wolves as manager before he got the Spanish job, when he was with the under-21s, and then basically got a better offer from Spain and kind of bumped them off. And then that's when they appointed Nuno, and obviously it's gone very well for them. But so it's not... I don't know the man, but it doesn't seem out of character.
Well, Gab, you described it on Twitter as devious and unprincipled from Lopetegui, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, look, admittedly, early on, we only heard, you know, the Spanish FA side of the story. And basically, Lopetegui came out this evening, Thursday evening, and said, look, Spanish FA, you know, Rubiales was the first guy I told. He's the head of the Spanish FA, and this, all of this happened so quickly and so on. And I, you can't escape the fact that he didn't tell them. If he had come out and he said, "I have this offer from Real Madrid, you know, I know it's going to be potentially problematic because obviously we've got Real Madrid players and Barcelona players in the squad, and but I promise I'll give 100%. The squad's united. Blah blah blah. You know, can we make a plan? Figure out how we're going to handle this." It might have been okay, but that didn't happen. And there's another element there. I mean, Matt mentioned Wolves, of course. You know, the guy who made this deal happen was George Mendes, who...
Surprise.
Careful what I say about... Yeah, I got to be careful what I say about him and Wolves. But the interesting thing was today, the whole question of who knew what and when came up. And today at the press conference, it's Sergio Ramos, who, of course, is a Spain captain. And there's been, you know, accusations and everything in Madrid. When we went to the Spanish media, we have to remember how polarized everything is, right, between Barcelona and Madrid. But there had been suggestions and accusations that all of this was orchestrated by Sergio Ramos, who, you know, seeing that, you know, they had the shock departure of Zidane, they couldn't get a manager, that he'd almost kind of acted as a kind of the go-between before Mendes got involved. I have no clue if this is true. But I do know that, you know, when he was asked directly, like, did you know that the negotiation was going on? You know, he kind of skirted it and he said, well, look, you know, it's normal in a team that, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm the captain of the Spain team. Sometimes captains know more than other people, but we need to put all this behind us. So I don't know. We'll see how long this bad blood lingers. Certainly Real Madrid tonight, they were very adamant that they had done nothing wrong. And I think one of the overlooked things in all this is that if Spain somehow bomb out at the World Cup, you know, he's not going to be a part of that. You know, he's not going to be tarnished if things don't go according to plan, if they somehow come up short. So I think he's the real winner in all this.
Well, Spain obviously had to bring someone in, and that's the former Spanish defender, now the Federation's Director of Football, Fernando Hierro, who takes charge. He's only ever actually managed once. That was at Real Oviedo. That was the one season. So can he just come in and take on what Lopetegui has left behind, Matt?
Bottom line is, I don't know. But, I mean, it seems like Sergio Ramos basically runs the team, runs his club, injures players when he wants. There's nothing this man can't manipulate. I love this sort of image he's now got. He's the new Suarez, isn't he? He's a football's pantomime villain. Joking aside, it's an experienced squad, isn't it? You've got players who've been there, won everything, so they should be able to rally themselves. I mean, what I find fascinating is whether the Barcelona players will, you know, take umbrage at Real Madrid, causing more trouble, and those kind of wounds which Del Bosque did so well to heal could maybe open up again. I don't know.
Hughie said Ramos runs the team, and obviously is an important role, but Hierro kind of was Ramos before Ramos in terms of his role with the Spanish national team as a player. You know, 89 caps, Real Madrid legend. Some might even say Bolton Wanderers legend too. And weirdly, for a guy who was played most of his career as center back and as defensive midfielder, for a long time he was also the all-time leading goal scorer in the history of the Spanish national team with 29 goals. But I think it's worth remembering that, you know, he had this role of technical director at the Spanish FA between 2007 and 2011. And that's obviously when they won the Euros with Aragonés and when they won the World Cup with Vicente del Bosque. So he was a big part of that. He really has everybody's respect. He came back as technical director in between. You know, he did only have 1 year as a manager, but he was also Carlo Ancelotti's assistant when they went and they won the Champions League. So, you know, he's a football guy. He knows it inside out. And like I said, you know, he's been part of Lopetegui's setup. And, you know, when he spoke today, he said, look, nothing's going to change. I mean, we're going to go on the same path. It's Lopetegui's coaches, Lopetegui's philosophy, Lopetegui's way of playing. You know, I'm certainly not going to go and change that. I'm going to respect the work that's got us to this point.
Every manager says concentrate on the job in hand. Don't be distracted. Obviously, Lopetegui was distracted. And Portugal also seemed to have some problems as well, Gab. Four of their squad currently trying to terminate their Sporting Lisbon contracts. What's the story going on there?
Yeah, this is a remarkable story. I think one that, you know, I'll have to be slightly careful what I say and try to stick to the facts. But Sporting Lisbon, late in the season, they suffered a little bit of a collapse in the league. I think they ended up finishing third. This angered the supporters and it angered the president. And at one point, this group of supposedly 50-odd masked Sporting Lisbon, you know, supporters, but you know, I think the word thugs is probably more appropriate. They just rocked up to the training ground one day, went inside, and decided just to beat everybody up. There's been all sorts of speculation that maybe it had been an inside job, somebody at the club who perhaps wanted to teach the players a lesson and motivate them in some twisted way. The point is, these players have said enough is enough. You know, the club has a duty of care. I think they've stopped short of saying that this was orchestrated by somebody at the club, but you know, they certainly feel that, you know, that they have a legal argument to go and rescind their contracts and leave the club on a free. So if this was something that was orchestrated, it obviously backfired.
Indeed, one to watch out for. Gab Marcotti, enjoy what's going to be a fascinating match between Portugal and Spain.
My pleasure. Take care.
That's it for now. Many thanks to my guests today, Matt Hughes, Oliver Kay, Gab Marcotti and Henry Winter. Subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. For a limited time only, it's just £1 a month for your first 3 months. Simply search The Times Sale for more information. We'll be back on Friday night after Spain take on Portugal, and we'll also look back on Egypt versus Uruguay and Morocco versus Iran in the company of Matt Dickinson and Alison Rudd.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.